Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is Bringing the Power of Emotional Engagement to Work with Lawler Kang. And this is an interactive program tonight, so you should all have your worksheet to work on. And that's about all we need to know right now. I'll tell you a little bit about Lawler. Lawler Kang is the CEO and founder of Engage. After 15 years of corporate and entrepreneurial leadership, Lawler was on vacation and, being a recovering consultant, started doodling a process that became the genesis of his current work. Soon thereafter, he walked away from Empire Building, wrote Passionate Work, which, by the way, we will have for sale afterwards, and founded Engage, Inc., whose mission is aligning leaders, teams, and talent to emotionally engage with their work. Speaking and consulting clients include Google, Oracle, Microsoft, Yahoo, Booz Allen Hamilton, Pfizer, YPO, SHRM, Business Objects, Harvard Business School, Columbia Graduate School of Business, and the MIT Sloan School of Business. Lawler's past endeavors have included leading the successful turnaround of 3 out of 4 technology services and biotech firms, serving as engagement manager and then growing the Northeast practice of Scient, a technology consultancy, to 100 plus colleagues, recording the highest colleague satisfaction and lowest attrition rate of 11 global offices, and a number of merger and acquisition, brand identity, and internet strategy consulting. Lawler's been quoted in virtually every major business publication and has appeared on many broadcast networks. Lawler's a graduate from the Wharton School, the University of Pennsylvania, and Vassar College. He resides on the North Shore of Boston, where, when not serving as a human jungle gym for his 3 hooligans, he loves to ski, surf, and play bridge. And before I introduce Lawler, I just want to let you know that Lawler's book will be for sale afterwards. The books did not arrive, but Lawler will be signing a book plate for those books. The books will be for sale in the library. A young man named Austin will be selling them along with the books for the other program next door. So if you'd like to buy Power at Work afterwards, you can buy it, and Lawler will sign the book plate, and it will be mailed to you free of cost. So with that, I'd like to introduce Lawler Kang.
Thank you, Kevin, very much. So you may have noticed we are currently in the middle, hopefully, of the most unforgiving economic climate in our lifetimes. It's a good chance your business and your careers are at pivotal inflection points in the revolution. Research supports the intuition that if we can weather the storm, we'll all make it through more powerful and stronger. That's great, but what about now? Right? What about now? I've got this much workload, this many heads to do it. How do I bridge this gap without burning both myself and my team members out? From my experiences, growing companies, starting companies, and turning around companies, the best way to sustainably increase productivity and happily is by allowing you and your team members to bring your passions to work. I'd like to start off by sharing 2 interlocking philosophies to set the groundwork for what I call emotional engagement. The first is based on this book, Good to Great. Have any of you read Good to Great here by chance? Yeah. It's a phenomenal read. Jim Collins, in his research, reveals that of the 11 great companies, they shared 3 common characteristics. One being the management and employees had a passion for the business. And the focus here was not to stimulate passion, but to discover what makes you passionate. And this graph showing cumulative stock returns over time of the great companies versus their competitive set, I can't think of a better example of the power of passion at work. And it was a 700% greater stock achievement there. The second philosophy, which links with this one, is simply 2 words uttered by a gentleman named Socrates a couple of thousand years ago. Know thyself. Know thyself. From my experience, and actually Karen Davis, my business partner who is here in absentia, from our experience, the 3 L's of living, to live happily, to lead successfully, and to love and be loved, requires you to know thyself, to be authentic, to be real. And this can get tricky, very tricky actually. And the tool set that I'll be walking you all through in a few slides here has been designed exactly for that purpose, to help you and your teams get to know each other a couple iterations better. And this diagram here sort of encapsulates only myself in terms of making sure your head and your heart are going the same direction. All right, I'd like you all right now, there were two sheets when you walked in the door here. The bottom one says evaluation. I live and die on feedback. I can take it to me, give it to me. I can handle the truth. And if you want a copy of today's slides, just let me know there on this forum. I'd be happy to send you the slides. The top one is this for you, and this is for you to take notes on. And there is a little field in the upper left-hand corner called current alignment. I'd like you all right now, on a scale of 1 to 10, rate how engaged you are with your work, how passionate you are about how you're spending 11 and a half hours every day. 1 being completely disconnected, 10 being completely in sync. 1 disconnected, 10 in sync, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Anyone score 8 or higher? 8 or higher? Not bad, not bad. I think we're going out for drinks afterwards, so we'll see you at the bar there. No. Regardless of your score, I want today to be the first day of an ongoing process to help you improve your score. All right, so agenda for tonight. First, I'm going to make the case, as silly, as asinine as it may sound, why we should bring our passions to work. I'll then show you how to emotionally engage with your work using the tool set I just referred to. I'll then show you how you can extend your emotion or this engagement to your teams. And then I'll close with some slides about your role as leaders in whatever context to the best of your abilities and desires. Because right now, I will posit, we are facing a shortage of leadership, all levels, all sectors, all functions of society. And the odds, frankly, and the issues are too big to ignore. So I ask you all, if there's one thing I want you to come away with today, is that you can be a leader in your own special way. All right. So I'd like to start making the argument why we should bring our passions to work, asking you 2 interrelated questions. Oh, I'm sorry. I'd like to start making this argument with a quick commercial break. Where'd you come from?
When I grow up, I want to file all day.
I want to claw my way up to middle management.
Be replaced on a whim.
I want to have a brown nose.
I want to be a yes man.
Yes woman.
Yes sir. Coming sir.
Anything for a raise sir.
When I grow up,
I want to be underappreciated.
Be paid less for doing the same job.
I want to be forced into early retirement.
What did you want to be? What did you want to be? And remember this ad? Remember this ad, anybody? Can anyone tell me when this ad first aired? Super Bowl. That's right. When? Last year? 06? 1999. Let's TiVo back 11 years now, right? The stock market was on fire. Dot-com dynamo was churning along. Didn't matter if you were corporate David or Goliath. Your ad coffers were bursting at their seams. 99 was a year of profligate Super Bowl spending, yet this ad eclipsed all others. Time magazine ranked it top 10 pieces of entertainment. Ad Age voted ad of the year. But most impressively, many of you in this room still remember this ad after literally probably millions of branding devices have bludgeoned our poor eyeballs. If you ask the folks at Mullen, the design shop that created this campaign, they'd say that is by no accident. They wanted to, in 30 seconds, connect with your core, your reason for being, your dreams. Dreams what you always thought you could be. Dreams what you still think you can become. Was the ad successful? 24 hours prior to it showing, Monster received 84,000 hits. 24 hours after its kickoff, Monster logged on over 2.4 million unique visitors. Probably the best ad conversion spend ever. Now, these numbers underscore a very sad fact. Many of us out there are not living our dreams, even at the height of the bubble. Many of us out there are merely working jobs. In fact, a journal survey recently revealed 3/4 of the American workforce, who are still employed, are living paycheck to paycheck. From experience, it is hard to realize your dreams living paycheck to paycheck, which is frankly why I'm here to present to you all today. I want each and every person I can touch in my lifetime to be able to realize their dreams. So long as you treat your dreams as goals and develop pragmatic plans to make them happen. And given the amount of time, we all spend this really funny thing called work. A good place to start this process is arguably by showing a little passion at work. So I'd like to continue making the argument why we should bring our passions to work, asking you two interrelated questions. First question, why do you work so hard? Why did you study so hard? Why did some of you go off and get graduate degrees? Why do we spend most of our waking and probably many of our sleeping cycles thinking about this thing called work? This question only bothered me for about 15 years. One buoy kept bobbing the surface, though. Control. We all want control of our lives. Control of where we live, how much we make, our earning potential, where our kids go to school, who we sleep with at night. And we'll go to some pretty absurd ends looking back, just to gain one or two more slugs of this thing called control. Brings me to my second question. What will your legacy be? What will your legacy be? Does anyone here know the story of Alfred Nobel, or more specifically, what enabled Alfred Nobel to fund the Nobel Peace Prize? Dynamite. Who said it? Brilliant. Alfred Nobel had the patent on nitroglycerin. At the time, the most powerful force on the planet. Millions of people died because of this invention. We don't know, unfortunately, when or why he decided to leave his entire estate to the pursuit of peace. The important thing is that he did. He was able to, in the time of his life, decide how he wanted the world to remember him. What do you want your legacy to be? Now, people say, you know, Alfred Nobel, he had more money than God. How can I compete with the likes of that? Guess what? Everyone in this room has something, from my perspective, which is much more valuable than money at their disposal. Can you tell me what that is? Time. Exactly. Time. On that note, can anyone tell me here, there's a pattern here that only one of these people breaks, but there's a pattern here. Can anyone tell me what the pattern is here amongst all people on this screen except for one? They're all alive. They are all alive. I'd like to share a story of a very good friend of mine to bring this dynamic maybe a couple steps closer to home. My good friend and I, both born in Los Angeles, both had a relatively nice upbringing. At 10, his parents separated. This was L.A. It was trendy. Things were still pretty cool. My good friend was a go-getter, captain of the football team, freshman class president, Eagle Scout, blah, blah, blah. Playing football, though, he gets whacked hard in the head, keels over in the field, has a grand mal seizure, wakes up paralyzed waist down. He's taken to the hospital where he's diagnosed with an aneurysm. Can anyone tell me what an aneurysm is? Yeah, blood clot in your brain or your heart. This one happened in my friend's brain. Here's an angiogram of roughly the same place in the brain where it happened. New York Times had some numbers. 30,000 cases of this stuff happen per year in the States. Of those, 15% die in the first 2 minutes of trauma. Of the remainder, half die typically within a month due to surgery. Of the remainder, half again come out of surgery, paralyzed, loss of faculties, etc. My good friend was operated on, coma for 4 days post-op, came out of the coma, right side paralyzed, blind one eye, and mute. About 10 days after coming out of this coma, his parents told him the separation was going to be final. My friend predictably rebelled, but he didn't drop out. And I said to myself, you know, I got to keep an eye on this guy because something's going on with this guy. Applied to college, got into college. But then for no apparent reason, over the next 2 years, he had not one, not two, but three major abdominal surgeries. Each took about 30 pounds off of him, left a total of roughly 50 staple scars in his abdomen. Now, at the end of his last month-long hospital stay, he started thinking to himself, you know, someone out there doesn't like me. If all life is going to be as one constant revolving door in and out of hospitals, I'm not sure that life's for me. It was then he realized inside each and every one of us is a core of unbreakable steel, or passion, life, whatever you want to call it. He realized we create our destiny, and we control our destiny. No matter what life or death, the economy, our parents throw at us, we are in control. And it's how we respond to these external stimuli that's the important thing. With this somewhat naive philosophy in mind, he went back, graduated from college, and I'm very happy to say that the rest of my good friend's story was recounted to you at the beginning of this presentation by Kevin. My good friend is actually me. More specifically, it's my past. And we cannot share our happiness of sharing our story with you all today. So, four reflections from this story. First reflection, I had this one about 3 years ago. Doesn't matter if you're old or young, fat or skinny, tall or small, sexy or sexier. All our hopes, our dreams, our ambitions in life, and frankly our memories, our past, are separated from oblivion by 2 millimeters of cell wall in our brains or our hearts. You can't test for it. 2 millimeters. That's it. Not to mention the myriad of other things that can go wrong in our bodies. Brings me to a second takeaway. We don't purr. We don't meow. We're not cats, right? We don't get 9 lives. Life's a one-shot deal. And because of that, I strongly suggest try to make friends with your past. We've all done things we regret. We wish we could go back and do over again. No matter how hard you push space-time, though, you can't go back. What you can do, though, is forgive, forget, and try to move on. Because whatever you do in life, whatever you sweep under that rug, will only cause bumps down it. Final takeaway, and this is kind of obvious given the topic, whatever you do in life, do it with passion. A funny observation about taken from my 20 years now almost of corporate entrepreneurial turnaround experiences, people will comp you nicely to work your passions. Huh? Why will someone pay me to do what I love to do? Question to you all. You're good at it. You may even be great at it, right? And guess what? If you're great at something, there's a good chance someone will pay you a premium for that, right? Now, this graph shows if you invested $1 in the great companies Jim Collins followed, over time it would have been worth $470. This is a very good example of people paying you to work your passion. Now, the reason I put comp there, though, is I'm sure most of you by now have realized that all that glitters is not gold, right? There are many other ways to compensate people that are non-financial, which have maybe equal, if not better, engagement capabilities, right? Knowing you went to bed today doing a great job, knowing you improved the world in your own special way. That charge is almost priceless. So some quotes here. I traded an email in researching my book with Jack Welch. The purpose of the thread was, how did you do it? How did you grow your company's market cap from $50 billion to $500 billion in 17 years? His response, Lawler, businesses are made of people. Whatever you do, be yourself, know thyself, and work with passion. Jack Welch understood the way to make people and the organizations in which they work flourish at the same time was to marry up the missions and passions of the organization with the missions and passions of the people. Now, this struck me as a little odd. I always had the impression that GE was a kind of place where everything everyone wore was blue, including their underwear, and people around the world started and finished the day with a rousing chorus of, we bring good things to life. And here's the CEO of his 200,000-person organization saying the way to get ahead is to be yourself. GE was not the right place for everyone to work. I probably would have, killed myself there. But for those who could marry up their missions and passions with the organization, it was corporate nirvana. Okay, now, Jack never reported to this person, but I'll bet he would have liked to in a shareholder context. The setting is an investor's office. Some business school kids have been allowed to ask this investor questions about the career. Young woman raises her hand. Mr. Investor, what should I look for in my first job at a business school? His response, never do what you don't enjoy. Doing so is like saving sex for your old age. Not a very good idea. Anyone tell me who said this? Venture a guess?
Warren Buffett.
Very good. Warren Buffett. And I like to follow this up by saying, because now all I can do is eat ice cream. No. Now, what's interesting about this, how much was Warren Buffett worth? One time, $50 billion, give or take a couple hundred million, market fluctuation, whatever, right? But he also gave $34 billion to the Gates Foundation. Warren Buffett, like Alfred Nobel, I think, realizes how he wants the world to remember him. One final sort of note on passion. A book came out recently called Googled by a guy named Ken Alouette. And in this book, he interviews John Doerr and Mike Moritz, the two venture capitalists who initially invested in Google. The question was, why did you give two Stanford graduate students $25 million? The response, two reasons. First, they're smart, they're engineers. We like that. Secondly, we sensed a visceral passion to change the game. They wanted to change the game. And I think we all know how Google's doing now. Okay, so I'd like to share some benefits of working your passions just to make the point a couple steps closer. The first benefit of working our passions or being emotionally engaged with your work, I believe it can upend this thing called work-life balance. We've all heard this term, work-life balance. I've got two issues with this term. First, is balance possible? Is it possible to balance out the 11 and a half hours we all spend every day commuting to work? Or, I'm sorry, getting ready for work, commuting to work, working, coming home from work. Not to mention the occasional email sessions at night. Right, the occasional email session or office visit on the weekends. No, it is metaphysically impossible to balance everything out, which underscores a very obvious point. It's all life, right? It's all life. It's not like you can leave this dark, gloomy cave of work and then in this glorious garden of life at your whim. It's all life. Brings me to my second issue. Does this metaphor apply, right? Work wins, life loses, life wins, work loses? No, you should enjoy what you're doing. You should like your job. So I suggest banishing this term balance from our daily vernacular and replacing it with something perhaps more appropriate. It's not a question of balance, it's a question of priority. Figuring out what's important to you in different contexts of your lives and allocating our time appropriately. Sorry about that. And the third tool of my process has been built to do just this. And time permitting, I'll walk you through it in a few slides. Second benefit, I strongly believe that it can help us define success. If I told you that Kevin back there was a successful businessman, what's the first thing that would enter your mind?
Money.
Money. Exactly. He's successful. Boy, I'll bet he's got a personal market cap. I'll bet he's got a place on the Vineyard, a chateau in Aspen, maybe a condo in Hawaii. I'll bet he owns his own Learjet rather than having to rent like everyone else. Begs the question, what is money? What is this funny thing called money? Is it an end to a means? Is it a mean to an end? Is it neither? Is it both? It's, frankly, up to each of us to decide upon. Just some observations about this thing called money. First, having a lot of money and making a lot of money is not a bad thing at all. Especially if you do it with passion and don't break the law. But I like to balance that out with the observation that if money talks, it can also lie. Right? If money talks, it can also lie. A study came out of USC recently showing that if you make over $100,000 a year, your chances of getting caught in what are called consumption traps, where you need to keep buying more and more physical goods to keep yourself happy, goes through the roof. The only people who win this game are the credit card companies, by the way. A study came out of San Francisco showing, and tell me, the average shelf life of happiness from a product purchase. 3 days? 3 minutes if you got kids. Yeah. Actually, 2 weeks to 4 months, depending on how big a purchase it is and, you know, how technology, whatever it is. But, you know, think about it. If you got to keep buying stuff over and over again to keep yourself happy, something's not all right here. The same study revealed that the longest source of happiness are experiences. Experiences you can have for free, actually. So if money isn't success, or if money isn't success alone, what is this notion of success? Again, it's up for each of us to decide this, but I'm going to make a bold statement here, but isn't living life on your terms succeeding enough, right? Being happy? Nothing wrong with being happy. Forget the Beamers, and I'm not dinging Beamers here, okay? They're beautiful cars, right? But, you know, forget the Beamers, forget the vacation homes at Tahoe. We all have the inalienable right to define success on our own terms. And if you can figure out maybe some metrics of success, non-financial metrics of success, that can have an immense impact on your journey going forward. Okay. Some quotes here supporting this notion of success. Warren Buffett, great quote from Buffett. Success is simply doing what you love to do and being good at it. And we'll come back to this in a couple slides because this is a critical part of my overall process. Another great quote on success, Harvard University has been following graduates for 72 years. 72 years tracking them to figure out what has made you happy over the course of your life. People where everything was right needed less to be tycoons, the artists. They weren't going to be president, but they were going to be good at what they did. All right. The last benefit of working our passions I'll share with you tonight is I think it can really help us get what we all want, and I'm going to make another very bold statement here, but isn't that just being happy? Nothing wrong being happy. If you're happy on the job, your chances for promotion and comp bumps will go up 60%. A report came out of London about 5 years ago now, I think. I'm not going to tell you who did it yet, but this gentleman's job is to do research. He researched happiness. Came up with 5 things we can do in the here and now to improve our happiness. Don't equate happiness with money. Exercise. Have sex before someone you love. Seek work that engages your skills. Look to enjoy your job. Sleep. Now, if I told you this report did not come out of a psychological research lab, but came out of an investment bank, would you believe me? Lo and behold, this cowboy, James Montier, issues this report. I about fell out of my desk when it hit my desktop. I'm thinking, if investment bankers aren't equating happiness with money, the world is truly changing. And guess what? The world is changing. Dramatically around us, globally at breakneck speeds, at ways our feeble minds have a hard time keeping up with. And it's the people in this room who can make this change happen. Okay, just one other note on happiness here. Going back to that Harvard study, another great quote, the job of life isn't conforming or keeping up with the Joneses. It's playing and working and loving. And love is probably the most important. Happiness is love. Full stop. Okay, so hopefully I've made a case, at least a little bit, why you should think about maybe working your passions. I'm not going to walk you through a process real quickly to help you figure out what you're passionate about, what you're good at doing, what's important to you, etc. My business partner and I have come up with 5 questions we'd like to ask people to start off this process. So what's your mission? Or your ikigai. Do we all know TED.com here? TED.com? It's a phenomenal site. If you haven't checked it out, you've got to check it out. There's a guy named Ted Buttner who does research on what are called blue zones, are areas around the world where people are living abnormally long lives. One of these blue zones is is off the Okinawa Atoll. And people there are living 20 years longer than people in the States. A reason why? Ikigai means, literally translated, the reason I get up in the morning. Everyone in this community has a purpose. They have a mission. So what is my mission? What are my passions? What can I be the best at and love to do? Does my work fit my priorities? And are my dreams being supported by my work? Okay, and you'll see these themes repeat themselves a couple times as I walk you through this process. Okay, so at a high level, three tools from my book: passions, proficiencies, and priorities. These are icons of the tools. On a side note, each icon takes a standard business process and makes it personal. I come from the management trenches. I've been bludgeoned by every self-improvement tool on the planet. Most of them made sense to me, but I felt uncomfortable using them because they were in a vernacular I wasn't familiar with. So using things that you may not use all day long, but you may have even heard of, might increase efficiency here. So the passion pyramid, the outputs there are your personal mission, passions, and what I call releases. Proficiencies takes a balance sheet structure, makes it personal. You get talents and values, experiences, dreams, and founder stock. And priorities takes a classic consulting tool called the Matrix and helps us figure out what's really important in whatever context you want. Now, going through this process, both yourself and your teams can yield some really powerful benefits. It can help you figure out what gets you out of bed in the morning. It can provide the critical overlap between leaders and employees' missions and passions and values, going back to Jim Collins and Jack Welch. It can give you the capability to leverage holistic backgrounds, not just what's on your resume, but the whole you. It can also help you figure out what you can be the best at. And finally, it can be an excellent source of ongoing engagement once you go down this process. And I'll come back to this with a great example in a few slides. Okay, so the first tool, the passion pyramid. I am a recovering consultant. I have a pyramid. I'm sorry. Starting at the bottom here, I call these releases. They answer the question, what have I loved about my life to date? Right? And I've separated this into four buckets. What's in your resume, both educational and work experiences. Living is everything that's sort of off resume. What at 12 is based on some fascinating research which reveals what we like to do at 12 years old has the highest correlation with professional happiness. So think back, if you can, to what you like to do, roughly 12 years old. Get it down there. And finally, who or what inspires you? Once these buckets have been filled in, look for patterns in them, just like a marketing focus group or financial analysis. And ask yourself the question, why have I loved what I've loved about my life to date? And what I call meta-passions will quickly bubble to the surface here. Then ask yourself the question, what will my legacy be? And a mission statement or statements will actually very quickly appear. Let me walk you through the passion pyramid of an SVP of North American technology at one of the world's largest pharmaceutical firms. This guy's 45 years old, and he's on fire. He's got a $300 million budget, 1,200 people reporting to him. Why is he doing so well? He is releasing his passions here. He's drawing on his releases, releasing his passions, and he's hitting his mission very, very cleanly. He's a passion stud, as I like to call him, right? He cares about people. Doesn't matter if people on the street, his colleagues, his customers, the end users, he cares about people. I like this, too, because when he was 12 years old, his favorite TV show was Quincy MD. Remember that show, Quincy MD? He loved that show. So just an example here to show you sort of how powerful this can be, both individually, but and I won't get to this level in this presentation, but imagine having one of these for every one of your team members as well, looking for patterns in this information as well. It can get very, very interesting. Okay, so the second tool takes the balance sheet structure and makes it personal. Now, I personally hate financial accounting, okay? It doesn't matter if you don't like accounting at all. It's the structure I'm using here. There will be some geeky aspects to this as well, though. So balance sheets have short-term and long-term assets and liabilities. My version, short-term assets and liabilities are not cash and accounts payable. They're your talents, what you're good at and love to do on the asset side, and what you don't like doing or frankly suck at on the liability side. Now, what's funny about this is thinking back, most of our education and performance reviews tend to focus on improving our liabilities here rather than focusing on our strengths. I did some work for Harvard Business School, and after putting people through this process, this guy raises his hand and says, you know, you explain why half my class went to Harvard Business School and my career to date. I'm now managing a team of technologists. I hate managing. I hate technology. What am I doing in this role? It's not uncommon. We all want to be super people, right? But again, it's much easier conceptually to get returns from your assets versus your liabilities. Long-term assets and liabilities are basically, so I split this in two buckets, values you admire and love on the asset side and values you detest on the liability side. The experiences on the asset side are whatever life experiences you might want to bring to work with you. On the liability side, these are your dreams. Now, why are dreams a liability? You have not been able to retire them yet. They're generating interest, if you will, in a manner of speaking. They're gnawing at you. The final proxy to the financial version of the balance sheet, from my perspective, the most valuable part of a balance sheet is equity, more specifically founder stock. Shares that issue when the company's first started, right? Their value can be astronomical depending on how they're leveraged. My version of founder stock is simply the number of weeks we have yet to live, presuming we're good and die on time. Now, unlike stock that's recognized by the boards, you can't buy these shares back. You can't split them. You can't use them as collateral. They will always deplete, sometimes at an accelerated and uncontrollable pace. Right? We're not cats. So the question becomes, how do you want to use your founder stock, the most valuable part of your balance sheet, leveraging your assets here, recognizing your liabilities, to realize your dreams? Let me share with you my personal balance sheet just as a quick example. So my assets, my liabilities. Now, it took me 15 years to realize I'm pretty good at managing down, right? I was able to turn around three companies, but I suck at managing up, right? Every boss I've had has had issues with me or I've had issues with them. Dealing with the founders and the boards of the turnarounds was misery for everybody. It took courage, frankly, for me to put that up there. But once it was up there, I said, wow, that explains 15 years of my life. And it also gives me a really good data point what I should not do probably, right? Looking at my liabilities here, do you think I'd be a good commercial banker? Probably not, right? Consultant, maybe. So just a very quick snapshot as to how this whole thing can work. Okay, moving on. So the third tool here, the matrix, has been designed to help us prioritize whatever we want to. I've used it to help figure out what companies my clients should buy to where we should go on vacation. It's that flexible. Let me walk you through a topical example here. Let's take life just for the sake of example. The first step is to figure out what criteria are important to you. So let's say that in the life context, work, money, activity, family, and friends are important to us. Again, this is just for the sake of example. It's up to you to figure out what criteria you want to put here. Ignoring the redundant cells here and working left to right, ask yourself, is what I do for work more important than what I make? Is what I do for work more important than my activities, etc.? If it is, put a 1. If it's not, leave it 0. Very simple 1 or 0 decision. And when you're done filling out the whole matrix, add them up there in the final column. And you get a quick and not so dirty, both quantitative and relative scale as what's important to you. This tool is based on the observation that it is tremendously easier getting what you want if you know what you want. But typically there's so much chaos swirling around us all day long, it's hard for us to really figure out what's important to us. Okay, so I'd like us all right now, real quickly, just to take maybe 5 minutes or so. There's a matrix here, the bottom of your note sheet. I'd like you all right now just to go through this process, just to see how it works. And please raise a hand, because it's a little counterintuitive. But the question I want you to focus on is, what is most important to you in interacting with your boss? Right? And if you have your own company, you might want to use your customers because they are the boss in many respects. And here are some popular criteria that have come up over and over again. I don't want to bias you, right? But just want to give you some things to chew on here. So transparency, dedicated time with your boss. Boss who understands me, my needs, who's open, who's authentic, who's a mentor. Trust, accountability, personal connection. And please raise a hand because it's counterintuitive almost going through this process. And
list them down in first column.
Yes. So list them down here and then across like that there, right? So if the row criteria is more important to you than the column one, put a one. If it's not, leave it zero. One or zero. So in this case, activities are not as important as work right here, right? But my family is more important than my work. Again, this is just for the sake of example. Make sense? Absolutely. So, again, the question is, what is most important to you in interacting with your boss, right? And, again, apologies because my font's a little small here. Transparency, dedicated time, understanding me and my needs. And, again, I don't want to bias you, but openness, authenticity, being a mentor, trust, accountability, personal connection, and whatever else you can think of. Okay. In the interest of time, people find this interesting at all? Interesting? Anything you want to share? Anything perhaps you didn't expect to see there? Or interesting? Okay. Want to share some results here? I'm curious, how many people, trust was the most important thing? Right. Yeah. Accountability? Nope. Yeah, a few. Okay. Very good. Understanding my needs. Okay. Awesome. Yeah. No, I mean, what's amazing to me is how similar, frankly, a lot of these responses can be. Yeah, if you look at the state of management and leadership out there, we have some work to do. Okay. And I'll come back to sort of the power of this matrix in a team context in a few slides here, because it can get quite interesting. And again, I just want to sort of plant seeds in your brains tonight. And frankly, what I'm asking you to do right now is a bit of a difficulty, because you've been trying to process what I'm saying with your left brains, and I'm asking you to be creative with your right brain, and it's hard to make that jump. So don't be surprised if tomorrow, the next day, you're in the shower driving to work, and something whammo out of the blue hits your brain, because your right brain is working on the stuff in the background. And if it does, write it down. Okay. So extending this sense of emotional engagement to teams. My partner, Karen Davis, and I, we've noticed that when teams / organizations align, you get three very, very powerful benefits. First job, your employees are no longer working a job. They're fulfilling their life's work, right? It's a big difference there, just working a job versus supporting your life's work. And that leads to emotional engagement, innovation, and accountability, right? Because we're all pushing for the same thing. We all want to get stuff done. Improved communication can build cohesion and trust. And increased happiness has an immense impact on our health, right? And given the state of healthcare and the cost of healthcare, this can have a major impact on profitability. Now, intuitively, adding up these three benefits, you get happier clients, increased productivity, and profitability. But there's a middle tranche here, which is absolutely critical to understand. It's sort of a self-reinforcing cycle of having the best talent the market can give you, who is also operating as mouthpieces or spokespeople of your brand, right? Your brand promise, your brand identity. And I did executive search for a few years while I was writing my book. I'll never forget, you know, I was working with some top firms in their fields, but the people who were doing the recruiting were, you know, dull as doorknobs. And I kept saying, there's no way you're going to get the best talent here if your people who are interviewing people to join your firm aren't engaged. It makes no sense to me at all. So how do you develop group alignment? If there's one takeaway we can share with you, doesn't matter if you use our tools, someone else's tools, it's this. You have to start with the individual and then work out to the team. You've all heard this term, there are no I's in team, right? I take a contrary viewpoint. There are many I's in teams. In fact, teams are made up of I's. Unless you can identify and align those I's with the goals of a team, that team is not going to run efficiently or optimally. This is another Fortune 50 company going through the process. And unfortunately, there were many women involved in this process, but none are in these pictures. But what's also what was a real blast to Karen and I was how involved the men were in going through these processes and how engaged they were with the process. So aggregating your eyes proficiencies, another step in the process is aggregating everyone's balance sheets. So, and this can have some really interesting impacts. Short-term assets and liabilities can be, what can we be the best at as a team or as an organization, which coincidentally was one of the other two characteristics of the great companies per Jim Collins' Good to Great. And what kind of support do we need? And that can have an immense impact on your recruiting strategy. Long-term, you get a set of codified values that you like and detest. On the like side, that can have an immense impact on how you communicate with each other and your whole talent acquisition and management functions, right? So using values to interview people with for performance reviews, compensation reviews, et cetera. What is off-limits here is also critical to get down, because I can't tell you, and people here who work for Scient know this very well. Actually, Melody shared a story with me today, which I've heard over and over again, is people would call her up and say, you know, my manager is not operating on our value system. And that's, there's no better way to sort of self-monitor your own employees than having a set of values that everyone agrees they don't want to have here. On the experience buckets, I'm curious, has anyone here ever gotten sort of an email from a manager about something that's important to them personally? A few times? Yeah, you're lucky. I've never gotten one, frankly. But imagine knowing, for example, that your father came out with colon cancer, right? And I'm your manager. I see an article online about this latest colon cancer therapy. I flip it to you. Wow, that's impressive, right? I'm taking an active interest in helping you with your life. Another great example of this, going back to the dream liability, did some work with a firm in Boston. A project manager did an immaculate job on a project. He was being fished by another firm to join them. His manager looked at his balance sheet, saw he wanted to visit the Grand Canyon before he died. A week later, two tickets to Las Vegas show up in this guy's mailbox. His loyalty and productivity have been untouchable since, because the manager and the firm as a whole is taking an active interest in helping him reach his life goals, not just his career progression. On the dream side here, you know, you have team goals, targets, but what we really want out of this engagement. Why are we actually here? Now, going through this, in Founder Stock, that's sort of the timeline, right? Sort of a project timeline, how many weeks we have to get to this sort of next stage of our company's evolution. Now, this information can have a dramatic impact on essentially branding, both external, internal branding, and company culture. So what we can be the best at can be a phenomenal driver of a mission statement. Dreams can be a great driver of a vision statement. And frankly, all your assets and dreams together come together in what we call cultural components, right? Let me give you an example of this. Did some work with a venture fund startup in Boston called Explorica. They provide educational travel services to high schools. And they went through the processes. Apologies in the back there if you can't read this. I'll read it for you. The vision statement, and it took some while to turn this out, though, but create a better world by enriching every student with a cultural experience through educational travel. Now, create a better world, that was the hook. That was the hook that got everyone in the company on board, looking at their personal dreams, looking at their passion pyramids. The mission statement, to be the product leader in educational travel, helping teachers and students discover the wonders of the world through safe and reliable tour experiences. So our work with them had, again, both traumatic impacts on branding, internal, external, and it ultimately helped the management team coalesce to a point to where they grew almost $40 million in revenue in 3 years, and they recorded a 40% drop in attrition. So, again, both revenue impacts and profitability impacts. Okay. So just one other sort of takeaway here, going back to the matrix, right, and aggregating your priorities. This is a matrix from another Fortune 50 company. The question here was, what is important to you in building this group? And you get all these answers here, which is good to know. But once you have this data, you can drill down into it. So you've got everybody's responses here. You've got group leaders, GLs, and team leaders, though, TLs. What's fascinating here, for example, is that recognition, the group leaders didn't need recognition at all, but the team leaders needed a lot of it, right? Inspiration, again, the group leaders didn't need a lot of it, but the team leaders needed it more. So it can be a very good source of information how you might want to manage your teams at different levels of the organization. And you can actually break this up by manager as well, which can give you some really interesting data as to how you can how to help your managers improve themselves. All right. Your role as leaders. Above all, you have to walk the talk. You have to be authentic. You have to be real. A good friend of mine from business school got her PhD at a school up in Boston. Topic of her dissertation was, why do you like your job? She interviewed 800 people from six different schools. Quantitative, qualitative measures, why do you like your job? No correlation at all between what people were making, their sector, their function, who they were working with. The Mount Everest in the graph was relationship with their boss, right? So if you have people reporting underneath you, you set the nature, the tone, the culture, the nuance of that group, and you have to walk the talk. I'd like you all right now to I'm going to make an assumption here that you all buy into this. You all believe bringing your passions to work is a good thing. The question becomes, where do you find the people like you now? I can't tell you the number of times I've heard the mandate booming down from corporate, we need more leaders. To which I say, hold on, not so fast, right? We all become leaders when our missions, our passions, our values, and our dreams are tapped. The question becomes, it's actually a two-part question. It's a question of courage. People at the top have the courage to know themselves. And the people who report to them have the courage to understand themselves and try to align it. Great quote here from Jim Collins. Some managers are uncomfortable with expressing emotions about their dreams, but it's the passion and emotion that will attract and motivate others. So, what is holding you back? What is holding you back from bringing, from identifying and bringing your missions, passions, values, dreams to work? What is holding you back? Precisely. So I'd like to return to 99. October 99. Scient was an e-business consulting firm. The fastest organically grown services firm in U.S. history, right? 0 to 2,000 people in 3 years. Didn't miss a step. Our market cap peaked at $9 billion. This was October 99. I think we'd gone public 2 quarters prior to that. Bob Howe, our legendary CEO, had most of the company in the New York City office, or San Francisco also had a large presence, and people were dialed in from all over the world. Bob Howe was big into transparency. It was the analyst call. He wanted everyone to know how he was dealing with the analysts. The analysts were blown away. I think we recorded $85 million in revenue that quarter. Not bad for a firm started 2 years prior. Not one question from the analysts. Good job, guys. Keep it up. And they were off. Bob then turned to us, asked us if we had any questions. We had no questions at all. We were the kings of Wall Street. I think our market cap that day was like $6 billion on a run rate of $500 million. Bob then shared some comments I'd like to close with today. It went something like this. First, I'd like to thank every colleague for their contributions to these results. Our client list is the envy of the industry. We have the best colleagues on the planet working for us. Our clients are receiving exceptional quality deliverables, and we're all making more money than God. Looking back for some of us at the end of the day, some of us at the end of our careers, the most important part of this entire experience is simply being there, being the center of the force, which is changing the way business is done, exporting capitalism, improving the world. Looking back, I can tell my kids, my grandkids, I was there. Now, Scient was profitable, but like many of our dot-com brethren, we went bankrupt 3 years later. I'm sure our customers have forgotten who we are. Our technology has most certainly gotten stale, and most of us didn't realize the financial upside. Looking back, though, Bob Howe was 120% correct. The most valuable part of that entire experience was simply being there, changing the world on our terms in our own special way. Scient was a seminal moment in my career, the likes of which will probably never be replicated except for Google. That said, I know each and every one of you in this room has tasted this notion of being there, improving the world using your own unique combinations of passions, proficiencies, and priorities, because you can. Wherever you are is where you choose to be. I wish you all a lifetime of being there. Thank you so much for the gift of your time tonight. So we have, I think, five minutes for questions. Is that right?
That's right. And I just want to remind our listening audience at home or on the radio that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California with Lawler Kang tonight, The Power of Engagement at Work. We are almost out of time, but we've got time for a couple of questions. So I'll turn it over to Lawler.
Questions? Yes.
Since knowing yourself is so fundamental to matching yourself or figuring out where you're going and why is it so difficult for almost all people to make any real progress at all with that? Why?
Great, great question. I've thought about this question a lot as well. I think a couple of things come into play. Expectations are a big one. Personal expectations, spousal expectations, societal expectations, familial expectations. And the combination can, frankly, get deadly sometimes, right? And I also think it's just because it can be a little uncomfortable, right? I've got a good job. I'm making good money. I'm not a lot happy, but, you know, things are pretty okay, right? Human beings can be very masochistic. You know, I can't tell how many people I've bumped into 20 years in a job they didn't like because they just lacked the courage, frankly, to try something new. On that note, I'd like you all just to run you through a little quick exercise to provide a metaphor as to what taking the first steps, just going through this process, might feel like, right? Because it's a little bit out of our comfort zone. I'd like you all right now to fold your hands, cross your arms, right? Feels kind of natural, right? Feels kind of cool, all right? I'd like you all now to reverse them, if you can. Feels a bit strange, doesn't it? Feels a bit odd, a bit out of our comfort zone. But if you sit here for 30 seconds, you'll get used to it, or more used to it. 5 minutes, it'll become even more accustomed to it. This is a very good metaphor, I think, to taking those first steps down, getting to know yourself a little better. Oh, and by the way, do I need to call 911? Has anyone died yet? Oh, phew. Okay, good. All right. Okay, you can unfold your arms. All right. Thank you for the question very much.
Changing the world and really had the formula. So could you comment a little bit about patentism, what to what help for?
That's a great question. I mean, I think the case of Enron, well, I suppose trust your gut, right? Trust your gut when you're looking to either invest in companies or join companies. Trust your gut. Ask yourself, does this feel right to me? Is there passion going on here, or is it some media-inspired or analyst-inspired fanaticism? Because from my experience, our guts are probably the best bellwether of whether or not something is real or not real. I don't know if that answers your question. In the case of Enron, I mean, those guys, I think, knew what they were doing was not going to last. That's why Skilling took off. Right? That's why Skilling resigned abruptly. So, yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm really interested in, for our company doing this RE matrix, exercise you did, and I can envision the problem of authenticity getting in the way of actually doing it. And so, what's the best, most authentic way to come up with the, you know, the parameters that you put in the matrix so that they speak to your team members, they speak to your company, they speak to what you're trying to answer?
Great question. First off, get everyone involved in that process. Right? First off, one of the foolproof ways of getting engagement on your employees is to get them involved in the process. Have them throw stuff up on the wall, right? Your first matrix may have 20 cells in it, whatever, and you get a little orange to go through, but you can quickly whittle them down to things that are really important. Yeah, but get everyone involved. Critical.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much again, Kevin.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Lawler Kang. And with this, the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 125 years of enlightened public discussion, is adjourned.